belongs to me. My wealth comes.
How far you want to go, bud? And he thought for a second. Far. So how far do you want to go, bud? He thought for a second and then said, far. So we rode for a few more blocks, and eventually his mom or somebody in his family started yelling for him. And he said, man, my mama's calling me. I gotta go. And he hopped off my bike.
That was just one of the many special encounters experienced by activist and cello player Ben Solis, who swapped out a traditional touring musician's life on the road with its non-stop plane travel for two wheels. He even packed up his cello on the back of his extra-long customized bike, starting in his native city of Lexington, Kentucky, in the American South. I'm Anna Carmo, and welcome to this edition of our Lead Is On podcast from UN News. Ben spoke to my colleague Yasmina Guerda when they were both at the COP24 conference on climate action in Poland. He explained how going at a more gentle pace without adding to the damaging carbon emissions that are driving global warming, he was able to reduce his carbon footprint and engage with locals on his US road trip in a way he would never have been able to in the back of a van. At the same time, Solis is joining together his activism with his music, creating songs that are inspired by places he saw along the way, from the Appalachian Mountains of his childhood to a marine research station that he recently visited in New Jersey.
Paddling through all the ghost forests of cedar trees that, you know, don't rot but certainly can't survive when the salinity of the water jumps up so much from sea level rise. So you have these ghost forests, and like trying to capture that in song or even just in music, that's one way I would want to build affection for people that can't go there. That's, you know, a soft thing to do, but at the same time, if it connects with someone, it's very powerful.
Solis' upbringing, seeing his coal miner grandpa slowly sipping coffee before heading to the farm, affected him deeply. Now he wants to help others connect to the land while raising awareness of the destruction stripping mountaintops away can cause in places like eastern Kentucky. Yasmina spoke to Ben at the Momentum for Change Award ceremony in Katowice, Poland, where COP24 was taking place, which, like Kentucky, is a traditional coal mining area with high carbon emissions that is going to need to adapt to the realities of climate change.
Yeah, we call them Ditch the Van Tours, and they're a product of years and years of traditional touring on planes and trains and automobiles, and kind of beginning to feel a little disconnected from the people and the places of the road. So was looking for a way to change that. And it's hard to just say no to opportunities, especially when you have, you know, management and booking agents that want you to go out and make money for them and for you. So I saw a commercial for an extended frame bicycle called an Extra Cycle, which immediately occurred to me that I could fit my cello on there. And so I called up the company and said, hey, if you'll send me a bike, I'll do some music touring on it. And that was the beginning, from my hometown of Lexington, Kentucky, down to Bonnaroo Music Festival. And from there, I began to tour around the United States by bicycle, some 6,000 miles over about 5 years.
So was there a message you were trying to send, either to the music community or to your fans or something?
Not necessarily a message. I was just trying to use the limitations of the bicycles to slow down. I'm really into limitations as bringing definition to art. So you can only pedal as far and as fast as your body will allow. And that changes everything about the way that you plan your touring, from the cities that you visit to how far apart they are and the size of venues. So in many ways, just allowing that limitation to exist fixes a lot of the things that are a struggle about the road, including the carbon footprint and so on.
And in those 6,000 miles, you probably made a lot of encounters. Can you share with us one or two?
Sure. You know, when you're pedaling through a city, it's very different than driving into a city. A lot of times the highways are limited access and you don't really want to be on a mini house. So you take the slow roads in, which used to be the front doors of these cities. It's the way the cities are actually oriented to receive people in many ways. And so those are kind of forgotten areas sometimes. And we were riding into Wilmington, Delaware. And in East Wilmington, at the time, was fairly run down. Every third house was boarded up, but the houses that had people in them were just billowing with life. I mean, people were out there hanging out on their porch, and it was a very vibrant area. And so we're riding through hippies on bicycles. And
you feel like that's how you were perceived?
Absolutely. We were white folks pedaling through a black neighborhood. We were obviously kind of grimy from pedaling for the last few weeks. But certainly people welcomed us because in that neighborhood, a lot of people ride bikes. A lot of people walk. And so they see their neighborhood very differently. And a little boy came running up next to me. He was maybe 8 or 9 years old and just was like, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, we're doing a music tour. It's just by bicycle." And he said, oh, can I go?" And I said, "Sure, hop on." And so my long frame bike kind of has a big seat on the back. And he hopped on my bike. Now, on a normal van tour or a plane tour, you know, if somebody hops into your vehicle, that never happens. What would you do? And so I didn't know what to do. I just kept riding and rode for a few blocks and eventually said, "So how far you want to go, bud?" And he thought for a second, "Far." "So how far do you want to go, bud?" He thought for a second and then said, "Far." And that just really struck me. So we rode for a few more blocks and eventually his mom or somebody in his family started yelling for him. And he said, "Man, my mama's calling me. I got to go." And he hopped off my bike. And just that encounter was really special to me because it shows that when you use limitations, you can also lower your boundaries between yourself and other people. You can't roll up your windows on a bicycle in a bad neighborhood. So that is a beautiful limitation in my mind.
So you're talking about a lot of beautiful limitations. Were there ever any moments where you actually regretted doing this?
Certainly. There was a tour that we attempted on the Gulf Coast. This was maybe 2013, and the roads were still pretty beat up from hurricanes and so on. Certainly folks down there didn't have bicycling as part of their culture, and so people were taking a lot of risk with us on the roads. So we actually ended up kind of bailing on that tour, sadly, because it was just too dangerous. As me and the team put it, we're not trying to save the world. We're just trying to engage people and have a beautiful experience on the road. So, yeah, that was a bummer.
You advocate for environmental issues a lot. Why did this start mattering to you? Was there a moment or, I don't know, some moment where the beauty of nature hit you? Or was there education that was... How did you come to care so much?
Being from Kentucky, which is this beautiful, somewhat wild land of, you know, covered in old deciduous forest and lots of farmlands. My grandfather was a farmer, you know, coal miner, postman, Baptist preacher. He was all these things. And growing up, I always watched him kind of get up early in the morning, drink his coffee and stand on the front porch and look out at the forest. And I never really understood quite why until I started traveling more around the world and understanding just how special it was and just how much Kentucky was vibrant and alive and moving and, you know, all these disappearing streams and caves. It's kind of magical. And so when I found out that there was a practice of mountaintop removal strip mining happening in East Kentucky and throughout Appalachia.
Sorry, what, can you explain what that is exactly?
Mountaintop removal strip mining is a process of strip mining in the mountains of Appalachia. It's typically a practice that they use when the coal for underground mining is too risky to get to. So you don't want to send a man down when the vein is too thin. So what they'll do instead is use explosives to lift the top of the mountain off so that they can scoop it out, kind of like big black ice cream. And as you can imagine, it's a very destructive practice. What once was a beautiful, lush mountain is now kind of a moonscape. And rarely is it put back. And when it is, quote, restored, it's really just the slope and size and kind of shape of it. It's more of a, you know, a pantomime of what the mountain was. And certainly it's missing all of the things that took thousands, hundreds of thousands of years to develop there, the soil and the diversity and the bio environment. It's just, it's a really sad practice. And sadly, a lot of East Kentucky and West Virginia and that whole central Appalachian region has been affected by it, and including the people that live there. Certainly coal mining is a huge part of the heritage in that area. Many of the towns were built on coal mining, but not on the practice of strip mining, which is really removes and damages communities. So it's a tough thing to see. And so I wanted to protect that area, those mountains that were literally my backyard. And so I wanted to do what I could to use music to do that. And it's challenging. Music is not going to pick up that rock and move it. Music's not going to stop the bulldozer. What music is really good at is building affection around issues. So here we are at the UNAN Climate Conference, and we have tons of data and amazing minds and brains, you know, thinking of, you know, solutions from the business sector and from the policy sector and regulatory sector. But how do you help people care about that and take that data and turn it into something where people want to protect it? And so I think that is the role of music as well as art overall, is to build affection around issues.
And how do you do that? How do you build affection around this issue?
Well, I love creating works that are based on location. So actually traveling to places and writing in those places. I was just in southern New Jersey riding around a marine research station with Rutgers University and, you know, paddling through all the ghost forests of cedar trees that, you know, don't rot but certainly can't survive when the salinity of the water jumps up so much from sea level rise. So you have these ghost forests, and like trying to capture that in song or even just in music is that's one way I would want to build affection for people that can't go there, whether because of cost or time or whatever. I want to be able to help them visit it musically. That's, you know, a soft thing to do, but at the same time, if it connects with someone, it's very powerful.
Do you feel like people here can hear what you have to say and are listening?
I'm not sure they need to hear what I have to say. I do think that it's important when I walk around and see some of these very high-level talks to connect with people on an emotional level as well as a cerebral level, because that storytelling element is incredibly important if you're going to captivate people or even motivate them to take action. And so some of the most encouraging talks I've seen are about actions, mainly at the Action Hub. I've really enjoyed kind of seeing all the people that are out there with viable living projects that are on the ground making stuff happen. That is very encouraging to me. And often the thing that makes it really sell through is the fact that they have a story, a personal connection about something that happened to them while they were on the way to protecting the climate that I feel like connects with audiences. The data is important, the science is important, but so is the story.
You may have heard here at COP24, one of the issues that's being brought up is that, for example, in this region, Silesia, there's a lot of mining and a lot of the economy is based on that, mm-hmm. not unlike Kentucky, and that therefore there's a social cost that needs to be taken into consideration when we're transitioning to renewable energy. You may have seen some of that from where you're from. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you know how we can get people who are worried about their future, their actual future, their ability to feed their families?
Yeah, absolutely. In my experience, the folks of Appalachia and eastern Kentucky are incredible, strong, independent individuals. And the most important thing you can do is include them in the conversation. Because when you exclude them and tell them what needs to happen or what is going to happen, you're going to have a lot of struggle getting those people on board and actually making progress on your own project. So they need to be involved in the conversation, and they need to feel like their voices are incorporated into the next steps forward, because a lot of them understand the limitation of resources. I mean, they're the ones that went down and dug it up. They know how hard it is to get, A, and B, that there's not a lot of it left. But it's part of their heritage. They've invested a lot of time and health, and they've built their families around it. And so it's important to them. I need to hear that and celebrate all that hard work and effort, but also use their voices to find new solutions to move forward.
Hope you have a lot of nice friends out there. But just remember there's a lot of bad in beware. Ooh, baby, baby, it's a wild.
That was Ben Solis speaking with Yasmina Guerda of UN News from Katowice, Poland. That's it for this edition of our Ladies On podcast. I'm Anna Carmo. Thanks for tuning in.
I'll always remember you as a child. I've seen a lot on what this world could do, and it's breaking my heart.